Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, maybe you've thought about a living will, but for whatever reason, you haven't gotten around to it. We'll hear from an expert about why it's important to put your legal and medical plans in writing and how to do it. We'll also look at a big question for many high schoolers: what college to choose, and should you base your decision on prestige or cost? When students go to college, they're often unprepared for financial decision-making. A program at one Illinois campus is teaching the skills needed to ease some of that anxiety. We'll recap the primaries in the U.S. Senate races here in Illinois, and we'll also learn about what it takes to keep prairie habitat strong and how fire plays a key role. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We're starting off the show today with something no one wants to think about: your own demise. You will die at some point, so it's better to be prepared. Making a living will doesn't seem like a pleasant experience, but it can save you and loved ones a lot of grief down the road. It's basically putting your legal and medical decisions in writing. Mary Dixon and Patrick Smith of WBEZ's program Say More spoke with Lisette Ortegon, who is a staff attorney at the Center for Elder and Disability Law. They took some listener questions. We listen back.
So I know that you work for this nonprofit that helps older adults and people with disabilities in all kinds of ways, but it seems like it's just planning ahead. Why is it so important to make these kind of plans for, you know, someone collapses, is in the hospital for an extended period of time? Why is it important to make decisions now about something that may not happen for a decade or more?
That's a great question, and I'm really glad we're talking about this, because a lot of people think that advanced planning is only for older adults, but really it's important for anyone over 18. Advanced planning is about making your plans now, ahead of time, so that your loved ones aren't in confusion during an emergency. Mm. And it just means putting your wishes into writing and sometimes choosing the right decision maker so that there's not conflict surrounding that. Because, you know, we can't predict the future, but we can absolutely prepare for it.
So, Lisette, we've got lots more questions. I have my own questions. I know our callers are going to have questions as well. The number is 866-915-9239. Before we dive into more of the specifics, I want to talk to Sarah in Rogers Park, who has experience with this. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you guys?
Doing well.
We're good. And I understand that you, as a relatively young person, are already, you know, part of this kind of discussion. Can you tell us what's going on in your life?
So I grew up in Illinois. I actually currently live in Wisconsin, but I'm just down here in Illinois helping out family this weekend.
We'll allow it. It's cool.
We appreciate you making time.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys doing the show. My experience with living wills and kind of advanced planning, there's a couple of scenarios, but the one that really hits home for me is that when I was in my mid-20s and I was dating someone in the military, who I'm now married to, he was getting ready to deploy to the Middle East. He had to create a living will and kind of make some plans in preparation for that deployment. So while we were dating, we went and talked with his family and, you know, his parents and his siblings and, you know, presented all this information because he pretty much had to do it. So that was kind of my firsthand experience with it. We eventually got married and then we, you know, took time to update both of our living wills. You know, at that point I created one, and then it kind of hit home for me, like, how incredibly important this is, because you just never know. To think, like, gosh, what about me? Like, what if something happens to me? You know, we now have two children who are teenagers. You know, we've updated our living wills. And then also I have aging parents. I have a couple siblings with disabilities. Yeah, things are complicated. So I just can't say enough how important it is to begin the conversation, start taking action. And I think also to just know that it's okay to update it. You don't have to know everything that's going to be happening, you know, 20, 30 years from now. You won't know, but get it in writing, have the conversations, and there's a sense of relief.
Thank you for, I feel like Sarah is an A student. What do you think, Lisette?
She's made so many great points. And truly, a living will is just part of the advanced planning process. There's other documents that are very important, such as having your powers of attorney. There's one for healthcare and one for financial decisions.
Right.
And really, everybody needs both.
We were talking about, should we talk about everything today, or should we just talk about the medical piece of this, the being in the hospital or being in some kind of medical emergency piece of it? And I think that's what we're focusing on today. Mm. But I agree with Sarah. It took my husband and I a long time to finally nail this down. And I do think there's a sense of relief of, let's just talk this out, figure out the order of who decides what, and it is a little bit of peace of mind. And it, even though people feel like it's a little bit macabre, but I don't think so.
Absolutely. You know, I hear that from my clients all the time. After the process, they're so relieved. Yeah. And in my own family, you know, it took about 2 years of me gently pushing my dad towards this process because he didn't want to talk about it. He felt fine. Nothing's wrong with him. And he kind of felt like I was pushing him towards the grave.
Right.
You know, right. But it takes patience. And that's, you know, a key reminder that when we're talking to others about this, have that patience, have those conversations. Nobody wants to be told what to do. Start out with questions. What would you want to happen during a medical emergency? Who would you want in charge? Mm-hmm. You know, these are just really important considerations that when we decide them ahead of time, we're taking that power of planning into our own hands and not leaving behind confusion and conflict for our loved ones.
Lisa, you are a younger person. Do you have a will and a living will?
I do. I do, definitely.
How old were you when you first did that?
Well, I did it when I started working in this area.
Right. Yeah.
You know, a few years ago or maybe 5 years ago now, if you would have asked me, you know, I would have said, oh, no, I don't want to talk about it. That scares me. But now being in this line of work, I'm actually really empowered and I feel so happy to be able to help people make these sort of plans.
Right. Because it helps to make things clear and everyone's sort of on this literally on the same page with like this is what
absolutely
should happen. And that's not always what happens, but at least you kind of know what the roadmap is. Why don't we take a question now on the phone at 866-915-9239. Marcia is in Streamwood. Marcia, what's your question for Lisette?
I have a question about the medical documents. There's a number of different ones, but which would be the most important for, especially for healthcare? What carries enough weight with a hospital or with doctors?
Sure, great question. If you have a trusted person in your life, I really strongly recommend the power of attorney for healthcare, which you might have already heard about. Your doctor may have asked for it before a surgery or just a routine checkup. With this document, you give somebody that you trust the power to make healthcare decisions for you in an emergency and even out of an emergency. The Living Will Declaration is also very important. This is a one-page document. It stands alone. You don't need anybody to make decisions for you. It just basically tells your doctors that you don't want medical procedures delaying the moment of your death through artificial means like ventilators or feeding tubes if you're suffering an irreversible or terminal injury or illness. It says that you basically just want comfort care, things to keep you comfortable and out of pain, but it's not keeping you alive if there's no chance for recovery.
So that sounds like two documents that are very important. Would it be equally important, do you think?
If you have a power of attorney for healthcare, you would tell your agent, the person that you trust, your end-of-life wishes.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make both, certainly, and we make both of them for clients every time that we help someone. But the power of attorney for healthcare, those are those important conversations so they know everything about what you want and what you don't want surrounding your healthcare and end-of-life decisions.
I don't know, Marcia, does that answer your question? Do you have anything else? Is this something you and your people in your life are talking a lot about right now?
Oh, I already have them in place. I was just wondering, because there's also an advanced directive for healthcare.
Mm.
I just didn't know if there were one that carried more weight with the medical industry than another.
Sure. So actually, your power of attorney and the living will are advanced directives.
Okay.
Advanced directives is a category of documents, legal documents, letting others know what you would want.
Thank you, Marcia, so much.
Thanks,
so
Marcia,
much for calling.
For that.
Lisette, let me ask, and I'll play the role I often play on the show, which is the dumb guy. Like, okay, I don't have a will or a living will, and my feeling is mostly just that I haven't thought about it, even though I should. I don't think I'm afraid to think about it, although, hey, maybe we'll do this therapy live open in front of everyone on the radio. It's sort of like, well, I have a wife. I trust her. I assume that, with absent this power of attorney document, she would be the person who makes those sorts of decisions for me. Or am I incorrect that there is no sort of default person?
In a medical emergency, you're most likely correct. There's a law, a statute called the Illinois Healthcare Surrogate Act, that guides the order of priority for decision makers in a medical emergency only.
Okay.
But there's other situations that are not medical emergencies in which we can become incapacitated, not waking up right away after a surgery, a long recovery, or, as we know, the surge of dementia that we're experiencing in our society can lead somebody to be incapacitated, but there's not a law that says who would be in charge. Then their family, their friends, or the state of Illinois would actually have to petition for guardianship. And guardianship court is not where you want to be. By making powers of attorney, by making these advance directives ahead of time, you're really, in most cases, avoiding the cost, the time, and the stress of guardianship court.
And I feel like this is the time when I hear most about power of attorney and talking to other people is not the medical emergency, and I don't know which is more common, but when I've encountered it more often, it's the case where a person, there's been no medical emergency, but they are not able anymore to make informed decisions for themselves. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes that, as you're saying, it can be a very tricky question of who gets to make those decisions and who has the right to. I mean, it sounds like if there's no power of attorney document, that no one has the right to make those decisions until that is sort of worked out, right?
Exactly. And again, guardianship court is very difficult to even predict the cost, how much time it could take, because anybody that's involved that's disagreeing, everybody has to lawyer up, and you have to argue it out in court.
And it's expensive, it takes time, and in the meantime, there's someone who is in a situation that needs help, and there's a disagreement over how to provide that care.
That's exactly
so
right.
So that is why you want to get these documents in order sooner rather than later. And I'm saying that as someone who took a couple decades to get their act together. Our expert this hour is Lisette Ortegon, staff attorney for the Center for Elder and Disability Law. Thanks for being here. And let's get a question in from Sue in Northwest Indiana. What is your question for Lisette?
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Okay, good. I just want to make sure. What you're talking about is very relevant to what I'm going through personally right now. Mm. My brother-in-law has been in the hospital in Rockford, Illinois for about the past 9 weeks. Mm. And he does not have a will, or I don't believe a living will. Mm. And my question is, can an attorney legally come up to the hospital because he's kind of incapacitated? He does have presence of mind and he is conscious, but can an attorney come to the hospital to do the legal work of a will? And then the other part of the story is kind of complicated, but his ex-wife, who they want to get back together, is currently his power of attorney. And what we understand is if he passes away, then it goes to the next of kin, which is my husband, and he doesn't want all of that legal responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's been kind of complicated. So that was my question.
Okay, so part one, I think part two, you're going to get the you need to talk to the lawyer. Part one, though, can an attorney come to the hospital if someone is in compos mentis, of clear mind, and work up this paperwork, Lisette?
If they are clear mind and can make their own decisions and actually are directing the attorney to come to the hospital, it would depend on the agency or the attorney on whether their services provide that. But them directing the process is really the key to whether something like making a document while somebody is in the hospital is possible. Mm. If they're incapacitated, and here's the other part of this, you don't need a lawyer to make a living will. You make that on your own. Mm. And so whether we're talking about a last will and testament or a living will, because it can be confusing, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have very similar names.
Right.
The living will is for end-of-life decisions while you're still alive, but in that life or death situation or terminal illness. And the last will and testament is about distribution of your assets, which is more the financial component, which, I'd be happy to come back and talk about at another time.
Mm-hmm. Right, which I think we're going to do. And actually, you just answered Michael in Blue Island's question, who wants to know, is there an affordable online version or do you need to have a lawyer for the living will piece of this?
you can go to the Illinois Department of Public Health or just, you know, search it on a search engine like Google, IDPH, Living Will Declaration, and it's a one-page printout. You sign it in front of witnesses, you fill out your name, and then you give a copy to your doctor, to anybody that you think might be related to your health care.
Okay.
Can I just, if I can just make sure we're sort of wrapping up Sue's question there. If her brother is, her brother-in-law is of sound mind and is making these requests himself, whether it's a living will or a last will and testament, those are things that could happen at a hospital. The question is, obviously you wouldn't want somebody making a will sort of under duress if they're not, you know, of sound mind. But if, right. if they're the ones directing it, there's nothing to prevent them from, prevent him from doing power of attorney, a living will, or last will and testament from a hospital bed, right?
No, this okay. happens all the time in the hospital. You know, again, there's cases, law school memories coming back of people making these sorts of things while they're lying in the hospital bed. So you really want to be very careful mm-hmm. and not be providing the attorney, not be, you know, placing a document in front of somebody and saying, sign this, that can absolutely be questioned. So
right.
there's, you know, good lawyers will do a very good capacity assessment, have witnesses that are uninterested, you know, not hospital staff, mm-hmm. not family members, because legally you can't have them be the witnesses. So it's just a, it's a very delicate situation that needs to be treated with care.
Lizette Ortegun, staff attorney for the Center for Elder and Disability Law. If people have more questions, where can they find information from your organization?
Sure. So the phone number, our main phone number is 312-376-1880. And to learn more about powers of attorney, about the advanced planning process, look up Illinois Power of Planning. If you just Google Illinois Power of Planning, there's a very comprehensive website that we created in partnership with Illinois Legal Aid Online. There's all sorts of videos, informational sheets, a lot of information that's been broken down so that you understand the concepts behind these documents, and it helps clarify your choices so that you can make your own documents through a step-by-step guide.
Lizette Ortegun is a staff attorney for the Center for Elder and Disability Law. She spoke about living wills with Mary Dixon and Patrick Smith. That link for Illinois Power of Planning is available at our statewide show page. We'll have more in a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. From ramen noodles for dinner to retirement further down the road, college students face financial stress at the start of their adult lives like never before. Redbird Flight Plan is Illinois State University's solution to teaching students skills to ease financial anxiety. It's part of the College of Business. Dr. Kevin Algrim is director of Redbird Flight. He talked with Ben Howell.
A lot of these financial decisions have been made for them previously. Things like the grocery bills, things like essentially living conditions. These were things that probably their parents had paid for. They were always there, and they are going to resurface in a different way for these students. And many of those decisions are going to basically hit them all at once. And that's what's causing them so much uncertainty and anxiety. Everybody has financial anxiety. Students are at a crucial point primarily because they're about to enter the world where they're going to make a bunch of decisions all at once, including their first job, including the benefits for their first job, including probably maybe their first real-time apartment lease that they might not be sharing with other people.
What is the teaching like? Is it we're all going to meet for a class? Is it maybe a brochure? What's that like?
I would argue we're kind of similar to something like Career Services in that they provide a service, and what they need to also do is let students know that this service basically exists. So we've been trying to target some orientation type of experiences that students basically have to introduce them to this resource on campus. And what that resource does is provide live workshops that are framed in different ways. We're in the process of developing a newsletter that will be sent out several times, basically a year, so that we can update them on what the schedule is for upcoming workshops, as well as just kind of give them financial tidbits along a variety of different topics. And also just to kind of get them to think about financial decision making when maybe they're not.
A common complaint that I see, I think from my generation, Gen Z, was this complaint that some of these lessons about education for finances, for financial literacy, didn't really come out in like high school. Do you think there's a particular reason why it's not taught in high school curriculum, or is there a better way it could be, do you think?
I think they're starting to do that a little bit more. I think more and more high schools are at least having some conversations about it. And most of it, though, is sort of definitions. One of the issues is that we probably don't talk about it much in our personal lives, in terms of even parents talking to their children, because sometimes parents don't have the tools, essentially, to be able to understand their financial stress. And so being a little bit more open and honest and having that conversation, I think, is important. The other thing is money tends to be sort of, it can be personal, and at some level, it can feel like you're being judged, essentially, for how you feel about money. It, many times we might feel that it looks like everybody else basically has this figured out, but I don't, because I haven't had that exposure. But really what we're talking about is life experience, I think.
That was my last question. I didn't know if you had any other thoughts to leave off with, comments to make, anything that you feel like is important.
The only thing I would also add is that student workers are a big part of the development of this program. So it's actually, they're basically co-partners in a lot of the development. And what we're trying to do is make sure that things resonate with students in a way that they'll self-select into this. So once they understand what that resource is, when we go into these orientation programs, hopefully they start sitting up a little bit more in their chair. Hopefully they become a little bit more aware of some of the decisions that they're actually making. By having student workers essentially to help frame some of these issues, we can make sure that it doesn't feel quite as stodgy, as academic, but it's still sort of necessary.
That's Kevin Algrim, the director of Redbird Flights at Illinois State University. It teaches financial literacy to students, and he spoke with Ben Howell. Member station WBEZ lets listeners ask financial questions, and here's one that's timely.
Hi, my name is Calvin Buss. I am from Godfrey, Illinois. When looking for a good college, do I look for the cheapest college that I can afford without having to go take out loans, or do I take out loans and go to the best college I can possibly afford? My thought behind it is, will I meet the people that I need to get to those higher positions at a more expensive school, or will I do just fine without meeting those people?
To find out, we called up an expert.
Hi, my name is Sherry Greco-Rikus. I am Regional Director for EP Wealth, and I am also an author of the book Maximize Your Return on Life, Invest Your Time and Money in What You Value Most. What a great question, and this is something that a lot of clients ask, friends and colleagues ask. So I want to start with, there is no right or wrong answer. It's the answer is what's right for you and your family. Just to back up a little bit, I can tell a little bit about my own personal experience. I was one of seven children, and we all were going to college year after year. And my dad said that he would pay for a state school, but if I wanted to go to a private school or another school, that would be on me, and I'd have to take out loans. Well, being fiscally responsible, even at 18, and maybe that's how come I became a financial advisor, I actually went to University of Illinois. I majored in accounting. I met some of my best friends there. I actually met so many people that later in my career helped me find jobs, became clients. So for me, going to University of Illinois was a great decision because I left there without any loans. But there are a lot of benefits if you look at an Ivy school or a prestigious private school. You know, at U of I, often I had TAs, big classes, but at some of these other schools, you'll have great faculty, you'll have private interaction with professors. Yes, there is a great network. You probably will have people from all over the country, if not all over the world. And having that prestigious degree will open doors, especially with your first job. But there's a lot of things you have to consider. First of all, this is a family decision. This is something that parents and students should talk about upfront, probably when you're a junior, as you start to look at colleges and start the application process. But parents should really be upfront. What are they willing to pay for college?
and what will be the responsibility of the student? And one thing I caution parents, because I read about this a lot in the news, is that parents don't put your retirement at risk to pay for college, because you can't get loans when you're in retirement. Make sure that you have a financial plan and that you understand how much you're willing to pay, and making sure that you still have the resources for your retirement. So my advice is that students should apply to all colleges. Apply to state schools, non-Ivies, Ivy schools. You know, don't undercut what you may receive in financial aid, grants, or merits. But I also have been through this with my own children, and I've seen it a lot with other colleagues, is prestige should not be the number one priority. It should be the right fit for the student.
That was Sherry Greco-Rikus, Regional Director of EP Wealth.
Tall grass prairies used to dominate the Illinois landscape before European settlements and corn and soy agriculture. While there are very few prairies left in the state, what remains requires a special management technique, fire. Jess Savage reports.
It's a cool gray Saturday morning in a residential neighborhood in Naperville. A handful of trucks line the curb, and just as many guys are hanging out for their lunch break. They're wearing soot-covered work clothes. There's going to be fire in the neighborhood within the hour.
I'm afraid that they play around here, you know. When you dress like that, I think some kind of toxic material.
Oh, no. Nothing toxic.
Evan Barker reassures a resident there's nothing toxic happening here. In fact, there's nothing more natural. Barker is the burn boss from Piso Habitat Restoration. He's leading a prescribed burn around a stormwater retention pond. He walks around the pond, surveying the area one last time before they start the fire.
This is going to go pretty quick. We've done the work. You can see each tree has been cut around. All the material's been removed from around each tree.
The area honestly doesn't look like much. Maybe 10, 20 feet of dried stalks and some woody plants are in a tiny man-made pond. These are actually native prairie plants, and Barker says they require fire to thrive.
Part of the proper management of our native ecosystems, native plant ecosystems in this area, is fire. It's just as important as rain in the spring and snow in the winter.
Jamie Ellis is with the Illinois Natural History Survey. He's a tall grass prairie expert.
It is our native grassland that developed here in the middle of North America. It's the botanical diversity. The prairie helped build the deep black soils that support a very productive agricultural economy.
He describes fire as a tool.
That fire is going to, you know, burn off this standing dead vegetation. So it's going to recycle some of those nutrients, the nitrogen, the phosphorus.
With Barker's last minute check complete, the burn crew turns on a generator and assumes their positions at one end of the pond. Garrett Schneider holds what looks like a thick square of black mat attached to a broomstick.
This we call a flapper. This is just to extinguish fire by removing oxygen to it.
It's one tool among many.
We use water packs to protect things, and then we use this just to smother fire out. So this is like the last tool of the line, basically.
Once they light a small test fire, it's time to ignite the area for real. They'll communicate over a two-way radio throughout the burn.
All right, we can go ahead with standard ignition.
Copy.
What follows is far from what the neighbor feared. The crew coaxes a slow lick of flames around the retention pond. It creeps along, turning dried plant matter into black ash. Burn boss apprentice Lucas Slavicek says the light wind is an essential component of the process, but they sometimes ignite new lines of fire too.
You're letting the wind do the work, and you're letting the wind control where the fire is going. But it helps to speed it up versus having to go back and relight anywhere.
In about an hour, the whole ordeal is wrapping up.
They're all ringed up. I'm going to just walk around. I'll check the lines, and I'm going to take some photos for the work report.
The last patch burns up in a final burst. Barker says it was a textbook perfect procedure.
You kind of have to see it to get a sense of it. It's a lot more boring than people imagine, right? They see flames and they see smoke and they get real worried, but it's pretty subdued, don't you think?
It's hard to overstate how ecologically significant burns like this one are. Barker's an ecologist and teaches plant identification classes at DePaul University. He still struggles to find the words to describe the complexity of this ecosystem and why it matters.
Yeah, I'm not capable of describing why these areas are valuable. I can tell you that they are. It matters a lot to me. I feel like I'm actually saving some of these plant species. I'm actually like making sure that they have a place.
Prairie burns are taking place across the state this spring. By the summer, many of these areas will be bursting with native flowers and grasses. From Naperville, I'm Jess Savage.
When an Oklahoma man was killed by a tiger last year, that incident put a spotlight on the safety risks of owning those animals. A federal law restricts who can own and breed big cats. But as Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope reports, some animal welfare advocates say the rules don't go far enough.
Ryan Easley had worked with big cats for years when he was fatally mauled by a tiger at a facility he owned and operated in Oklahoma last September.
Tonight, a shocking tragedy at an Oklahoma wildlife preserve. A tiger handler mauled to death by a tiger in front of a crowd.
A statement from Growler Pines Tiger Preserve, where the incident occurred, said, quote, "This tragedy is a painful reminder of both the beauty and the unpredictability of the natural world." Easley's death resurfaced concerns from advocates about the safety risks of owning big cats. The Big Cat Public Safety Act, a federal law passed in 2022, restricts who can own and breed big cats like lions, tigers, and leopards, and bans up-close public contact with these animals. Rebecca Wish is an expert of animal welfare law at Michigan State University. She says the act was an improvement over the way things used to be and helps to control unregulated breeding.
You know, the whole idea of how many captive cats there are is just unfathomable. And hopefully this does lead to fewer captive cats, but I'm not entirely sure it will.
Before the Big Cat Public Safety Act, Wish says there was a patchwork of state laws, some stricter than others.
It didn't preempt those laws, but kind of cooperates with those state laws. So the state laws that are more stringent with regard to big cats still stay in place.
Animal exhibits that can own big cats need a license through the U.S. Department of Agriculture and must follow specific federal standards. But some advocacy groups say animal exhibitors should seek out an outside certification from independent groups that ensure higher standards of care for animals and staff. One of those groups, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA, has certified about 240 institutions. Dan Ash is the group's president and CEO. He says to get accredited, organizations must meet specific requirements, like having sufficient habitat space for animals.
So the difference in care is substantial, and that's why increasingly we're telling people, if you want to see these animals, go to places that really know how to care for them.
Ash acknowledges that getting this accreditation can be time-consuming and expensive. Some animal exhibitors argue these extra certifications are unnecessary and existing federal rules are enough. But for zoologist Trista Fisher, the outside accreditation is a sign that safety for animals, guests, and staff is a priority. She's a tiger expert at the Minnesota Zoo, which is accredited through the AZA. She says when these animals cause injuries or deaths at any facility, it hurts conservation efforts meant to protect them.
What the problem is they're doing these pay-to-play opportunities. They're putting the public at risk when they're interacting with animals, whether that be a small animal or a large animal, or they themselves are interacting inappropriately, in my opinion, with a large, dangerous animal.
Harvest Public Media contacted six facilities in the central U.S. that house big cats, but they either declined to comment or didn't respond to interview requests. In Eureka Springs, Arkansas, Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge has been taking in abandoned and abused big cats for more than 30 years. It's accredited through the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. Refuge founder Tanya Smith says many of these animals can't survive in the wild and deserve quality care.
We've rescued from 19 states now, from all over the country, plus two international rescues we've been on also just in the last year. So we've seen just about everything you can imagine, but I say that until we go on the next rescue, and it's just as bad.
She stresses these are wild animals, and when they're kept in unsuitable or dangerous conditions, sanctuaries like hers are left to pick up the pieces. I'm Anna Pope, Harvest Public Media.
We have more to come on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This week saw the primary election in Illinois. Illinois' Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton eked out a stunning win as the Democratic nominee in the race for the U.S. Senate. Stratton spent much of the campaign behind in the polls to Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy, who spent more than $25 million in ads that began airing last July. But as Mariah Wolfel reports, Stratton closed the gap in the final weeks with the help of progressive heavyweights and won with about 40% of the vote.
Supporters at Stratton's election night watch party at a film studio on the West Side were jubilant as she walked onto the stage to claim her victory.
I am humbled and honored to stand before you tonight as your Democratic nominee for the United States Senate.
Stratton thanked God, her supporters, her late father, who died while she was on the campaign trail, and she even thanked her main opponents, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy and Congresswoman Robin Kelly. But she saved no grace for President Donald Trump. Some supporters wore stickers that disparaged Trump, using a four-letter word that starts with an F. Stratton built her campaign around fighting what she sees as Trump's authoritarian agenda. And she says around courage.
Courage inspired me to run. Courage powered this campaign. And courage will bring this fight straight to Donald Trump's door.
Stratton positioned herself as the progressive in the race relative to the more moderate Krishnamoorthy and reminded supporters, some with tears in their eyes, of her key campaign promises.
We will fight for Medicare for all. We will fight to abolish ICE. We'll fight for a real living wage, not just the bare minimum.
Stratton's victory night wouldn't have been complete without an appearance from Governor J.B. Pritzker, her most visible cheerleader. Pritzker had a lot riding on the race. He lent his political prestige and his seemingly bottomless bank account to Stratton, spending $5 million in the final weeks of the campaign to help deliver her win.
A lot of people have suggested that this was personal to me. They were right. It was.
At a River North watch party, a somber Krishnamoorthy conceded a race pundits once thought he'd win as he congratulated Stratton.
Obviously, this is not the result we sought, but unlike Donald Trump, I'm not going to question the outcome.
Krishnamoorthy spent $25 million on TV ads that first began airing 9 months ago. So his second place finish calls into question the real value of flooding viewers with ads early and often. Kelly wound up as number three in the race, and her loss puts an end to her 13-year career in Congress since she stepped down from her seat to run. At the South Shore Cultural Center, she appeared before supporters and struggled to explain her loss.
There's reasons good people don't win. Good people don't run, unfortunately. And the good people don't stay in. Because it is hard to be, especially in Illinois, unbought and unbossed.
Back at Stratton's watch party, the Democratic nominee was already gearing up for the next challenge, beating Republican Don Tracy in the general election.
We will confront new challenges and new attacks from a candidate unfit to stand up to Donald Trump.
Tracy, the former chair of the Illinois Republican Party, says he's prepared for an uphill battle.
You're likely to hear Juliana Stratton call us extremists because Democrats don't have any other playbook. And they're going to make the election about President Trump.
For Tracy, his playbook for the November general election is proving that Trump and the Republican brand are not political liabilities in a deep blue state like Illinois. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Farmer Darren Bailey won the four-way Republican primary race for Illinois governor. The conservative former lawmaker will face Governor J.B. Pritzker after he lost to the billionaire in 2022. Bailey touted an endorsement from President Donald Trump last time, and Pritzker's campaign has wasted no time in trying to paint Bailey as, quote, too MAGA for Illinois. But Bailey says he's learned his lesson.
I won't attack people because they think differently than I do.
We can disagree without tearing each other apart. And when we work together, Illinois is stronger.
Conservative policy analyst Ted Dabrowski lost his bid for the GOP ticket. He came in second place on Tuesday.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. March 17, 1937, Illinois Attorney General John E. Cassidy outlawed all pinball machines. He called them pernicious and dangerous to the public welfare. City officials protested, noting substantial licensing and tax revenue from pinball establishments. The case went to the state Supreme Court, who ruled in 1942 that certain types of pinball machines could be classified as, quote, mechanical gambling devices, which had been outlawed in Illinois since 1895. Because not all machines were illegal, different cities created a confusing hodgepodge of local ordinances. Because these early models did not have flippers, players were at the mercy of the machine's mechanical design, and that's why law enforcement considered them subject to the 1895 ban on mechanical gambling devices. And in some instances, they were used for gambling. Establishments offered prizes, even cash, based on the game's outcome. Guests could cast bets like they were standing around a roulette wheel. Gambling aside, many churches and schools also believe pinball machines encouraged frivolity, immorality, and juvenile delinquency. The introduction of manually controlled flippers in the 1970s caused states to reclassify the machines as games of skill rather than chance. Chicago overturned its ban in 1977, but even into the 1980s, a Chicago alderman described pinball establishments as nests for gangs and drugs and tried to restrict pinball to adults only. I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
The structure of college classes will have to change in an AI world. That's according to Roy Magnuson, director of the newly created Adaptive Edge Institute at Illinois State University. The Institute studies new technologies and how they influence teaching. Right now, that's generative AI. In an interview with Charlie Schlinker, Magnuson says it will be possible to use AI to help students gain mastery of a subject, including artificial intelligence.
You can go in and say, look, I know you could pull the lever. I know you could just have this thing write you the paper. The paper is not important. I want you to be better at writing, right? So don't do that because it's, you know, a violation of what I'm telling you to do, and there's, you know, the ramifications for that. But also you're just, like, you're cutting yourself off the knees here. Like, you're not getting what you need out of the class, and the point of the class is to struggle, and that's okay. Like, that message needs to be there. Okay, so I say that, I have lots of colleagues who teach gen ed classes, and they have 300 students in the class, and that kind of dialogue is not necessarily possible. It's a lot easier to have that buy-in conversation with major students, you know, where you're going to see them, they see you as a mentor. If you're teaching a class of 300 students, it's much more difficult. We know this technology exists. It is not going to go away. As a university, we cannot ignore it, but that not ignoring it is not a, that shouldn't be taken as an endorsement of the tech, but we have to teach differently because the thing exists.
So how can you use AI to help the students learn how to write?
Sure. I mean, I think there are lots of strategies, right? So it can accelerate things, maybe. I mean, you can look at, you know, synthesis maybe more, so you have them write and get reflexive feedback, you know, from the AI. Or, you know, have them go and take, you know, a set of, I don't know, like bullet points or something and have it create summaries and have them react to those things. You can have them take an idea and have the AI split it out into 10 different social media posts for 10 different things and have them critique those things like they're looking at an intern, perhaps. And then being able to speak about it, right? And that's really, I think, one of the difficult things here is assessment. Like, how do we actually assess the student's learning? And what AI is kind of doing is saying, yeah, that's all well and good, but I don't have time to do that. So like that, the assessment of grading a paper, it fits into the structure of the class and the amount of time that we give instructors. But, you know, these things can be really interesting learning outcomes and interesting ways of looking at how to teach the class, but it's antithetical to the structure of the class.
You mentioned that having AI critique some of the students' work or respond to some of the students in some way. That traditionally is something that professors do.
Mm-hmm.
So what should professors be doing instead?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is you don't want to take yourself out of the loop. I mean, that's not the university's position. It's not my position. I mean, there has to be value add for the student. It could allow us to have different interactions with students. So should professors be giving feedback on student work through like an agentic system that they're out of the loop on? My gut is no, you should be doing the evaluation. However, is there a place for immediate feedback that is monitored and scoped by the professor that allows for a faster iteration loop for the students? Probably. I mean, and in a lot of different modalities, they can do it with audio or through many languages, or, you know, those tools are really powerful for that. So, like, I teach music theory, right? I mean, the fastest I can get them feedback is 36 hours, probably. I mean, they turn in the thing, I go, I grade it over the next day, and they get their feedback. I can still do that, but couldn't they get feedback throughout the entire process, too, while they're doing the homework? And that is totally possible, and I think that's fine. It needs to be really clear, though, what the instructor is doing. It can't be, like, the class has to change. It can't be that, oh, here, the system's going to grade for me, and I will change nothing else about the class. The students are going to see right through it.
Well, so how are some institutions already tackling that question? How are they changing to adapt?
Yeah, so, I mean, in a lot of ways. There are places that are advertising, you know, they're, you know, all gas, no brakes, AI, we're doing this thing, we're creating digital twins of professors, and we are flipping the script entirely. There are schools, obviously, that are completely, you know, abstinent from it. Like, we're just not using it, it's not part of our curriculum. I think both of those are wrong. The reality is our future is not going to be dystopia or utopia. It's going to be something that looks more like what we have today, but different. And I think our teaching needs to look like that too. You know, ISU, I think, is kind of in this middle ground.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Roy Magnuson, the head of the Adaptive Edge Institute at Illinois State University, looking at how technology interfaces with learning. What projects have you on your front burner that you want to accomplish?
Yeah, so we have a lot of things we're doing. We've set up completely on-premises secure compute. This is supported by country companies, which is great.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so it means we have some GPUs, so graphics processing units. It's the things that are powering AI, you know, in the data centers. Very, very small cluster that allows us to do completely on-premises secure. You know, if you can imagine a really simplified way, if you can access it like ChatGPT on campus at ISU. It allows us to do things like, you know, take recording data from, you know, six-year-olds at Metcalf and do transcriptions and inference on it because they want to get feedback and they want it accelerates humanities research in a way that is absolutely transformational. And that's been great.
Unpack that. What are you getting from those transcriptions? How is it helping and what's the research?
Yeah, so both at Metcalf and UHigh, the idea is you can record your class as a teacher. And then, again, this sort of like paradox here is that that's more technology you're putting in between you and the students, but it allows you to be more human. So you're just recording, you're talking, you're listening to the students, you're just doing the thing. You're not thinking in your head, oh, man, how much time did I spend on that? Who's talking? Did I remember this, that student, or whatever? Because you're getting that transcript afterwards. We have a system where you can go and transcribe it securely, get the transcription, put it into a system, and then have that thing, again, whatever boundaries you want to put on this as the instructor, give you feedback. Hey, did you realize you are talking 70% of the time? Or you, three people spoke the entire class, right? Which you probably are aware of as an instructor, but you're not like documenting your head, right? So you can say, wow, okay, those three students are high. I have to make sure I need to bring in this student or this one. Oh, that was a really good point that student has. I want to make sure in the next lesson that I, you know, follow up on that. So it takes that cognitive load off and puts it on an algorithm, which allows you, then as the instructor, to be more human, right? You're reacting to things and your instruction gets better.
Roy Magnuson is director of the newly created Adaptive Edge Institute at Illinois State University. The institute studies new technologies and how they influence teaching. He says another effort being worked on is a set of tutoring bots to help students in parallel with the class and keep them up to date on things the instructor emphasizes. Well, it's official. The severe storms in northern Illinois this month produced the largest hail ever recorded in the state. Susan Stevens has more details.
Representatives from the South Carolina-based Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety traveled to Northern Illinois University to confirm the record.
So I got 168.05.
They measured and created 3D models of several hailstones collected by Kankakee area residents during the March 10th storm.
Whew.
That is a chunk of ice.
Yeah. NIU meteorology professor Victor Gensini says conditions were right to keep the massive hailstones intact because many landed in the mud.
And so people were finding these stones, but they said some of the larger ones were actually hard to find because they were buried.
The new record is nearly 2 inches bigger than the previous state record. That was a 4.75-inch hailstone that fell in Minooka in 2015. In DeKalb, I'm Susan Stevens.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.